Permanent Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Permanent Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this April the 2nd on the West Coast, and now April the 3rd on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, with a special shout-out to our friends in the military. And also those listening in on blogtalkradio.com. Got some interesting news. I got a piece that I've absolutely got to play for you on tonight's show. Those of you who know anything about geology or geography certainly have a general idea what an island is like, how islands come about, and how they last through time. They can weather hurricanes and cyclones and tornadoes and tsunamis and earthquakes, and of course the surface structures, buildings and what have you, often suffer damages of various types depending on what the catastrophe is. But evidently one of our congressmen has anticipated a new kind of catastrophe on a particular island where they're considering stationing an additional 8,000 U.S. Marines and their dependents, which is estimated to be a total population increase on that island of 25,000 people. And one of our listeners was kind enough to send me a link to a video, a clip of a congressional hearing over the issue. And I'm going to play that. But first, before I do, I'm going to bring our resident scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray, onto the show so we can sort of discuss this in real time after I play the clip. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints. How are you this evening?
Pretty good, Don. How are you?
I'm in a great mood tonight, I have to tell you. And I think if we don't get one chuckle out of this, then I'll never play an audio clip or a video on the show again. However,
let's hope you don't come to that.
Well, we know how absurd things are in the district of criminals these days, and I can assure you that we have not been over exaggerating. In fact, there's one particular congressman from the state of Georgia that has actually outdone even our wildest imagination. And in his grilling of a U.S. naval admiral over this issue of sending 8,000 additional troops and their dependents to the island of Guam. And I think if you're willing to listen to this, I think we can open up tonight's show with this particular topic. I'll let it speak for itself. We'll allow the listening audience to make their own determinations. But we will discuss this, I guarantee you. You'll have something to say. I don't have the exact date, but I understand it's been within the last several days that this was actually transpiring on Capitol Hill, and you're going to hear Democratic representative from the state of Georgia, Hank Johnson. I use the term grilling this U.S. Navy admiral. And here's the clip.
Now, this is a island that at its widest level is, what, 12 miles from shore to shore, and at its smallest level or smallest location, it's 7 miles between one shore and the other. Is that correct?
I don't have the exact dimensions, but to your point, sir, I think Guam is a small island.
Very small island, and about 24 miles, if I recall, long. So 24 miles long, about 7 miles wide at the least widest place on the island, and about 12 miles wide on the widest part of the island. And I don't know how many square miles that is. Do you happen to know?
I don't have that figure with me, sir. I can certainly supply it to you if you'd like.
Yeah, my fear is that the whole island will become so overly populated that it will tip over and capsize.
We don't anticipate that. The Guam population, I think, currently about 175,000, and again, with 8,000 Marines and their families, it's an addition of about 25,000 more into the population.
And also things like the environment, the sensitive areas of the environment, coral reefs and those kinds of things. And I know that, you know, lots of people don't like to think about that, but, you know, we didn't think about global warming either. And now we do have to think about it. And so I'm concerned from an environmental standpoint whether or not Guam is the best place to do this relocation, but it's actually the only place. Is that correct?
This is the best place. This is the farthest west U.S. territory that we own. And, this is part of our nation. And in readdressing the forward presence and posture importance to Pacific Command, Guam is vital to this decision.
And that's the clip, Jim. I can answer this question just by going to Wikipedia. The island of Guam is 209 square miles, and the population estimated in 2009 was 178,000. Should they be bringing some additional 25,000 people onto the island, it will increase, let's say, up to 203,000, we'll say, estimating on the figures that were given. Could you make sense of what this congressman was actually saying?
Well, certainly. I mean, his concerns are absolutely justified. I wouldn't want that island to tip over, would you?
No, I wouldn't. But it seems that the District of Criminals has tipped over, wouldn't you say?
I mean, well, I don't know who the guy is, and I'm not going to get into it, you know, in the depth that I really would like to, but I'll tell you one thing. Brightness is not one of his high spots in life. The not only the questions that he asked, but my God, the way in which he worded things even, I got the very direct feeling that the Navy guy was doing his best to be respectful in a situation where he really felt that he didn't owe this person anything. And it's a real shame that that's the caliber of people that are running this country, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm. I wrote a little piece with this, and I actually posted this on my documentaries page. I just thought this was too funny to and I I included. I'll read what I wrote here. And this is sort of the summary of what we just heard for anyone that didn't understand what was going on. During a recent congressional hearing, Representative Hank Johnson, Democrat from Georgia, voiced his concerns that with plans to station an additional 8,000 U.S. Marines and their dependents on the island of Guam, quote, overpopulation may cause it to tip over and capsize, unquote. It has been speculated that this event may have been an April Fool's Day prank. No, it was not a prank. It was another example of business as usual in the District of Criminals. How the U.S. Navy Admiral, who was grilled by Representative Johnson, maintained a straight face and avoided totally cracking up with laughter remains a mystery and is speculative at best. After tripping over his expertise on geological issues, the congressman added the now obligatory comments about global warming. One wonders what has happened to the war on drugs. Maybe Congressman Johnson could enlighten us on that topic in an upcoming vignette. So I just felt like this had to be heard and seen by people. It's incredible that this occurs. And these are the people that just voted on this 2,700-page healthcare bill. It makes you wonder where man actually came from. And that enables us to go into tonight's topic. I wanted to talk about the topic of evolution. Now, to segue into that topic, I would like you to listen to the perspective in a song of an 8-year-old from the state of Missouri, who actually we featured this song on my show last night with his father, Mike Fisher. This is 8-year-old, at the time, 8-year-old Sam Fisher singing a song called "Did Charlie Make a Monkey Out of You?"
Good morning, class. My name is Professor Poop Fossil, and today we'll be studying the principles of evolution. Once I was a tadpole, long and thin. Then I was a frogger with my tail tucked in. Then I was a baboon in a tropical tree. And now I'm your professor with a PhD. And the question is, did Charlie make a monkey out of you? From a reptile to a monkey, then a man. So today I'm
little Sam Fisher singing "Did Charlie Make a Monkey Out of You?" Jim, I just heard an 8-year-old 4 years ago, now he's 12, make more sense than a U.S. congressman.
Well, maybe you should run for office next, you know. Anyway, it was an interesting song, and I think the kid did a good job.
He did an excellent job.
I actually liked the music and the lyrics. It was pretty good.
Yeah. How do you like that British accent that he did in the front, too?
Yeah, I was. It was pretty legit. I wasn't sure if he really was a Brit or not, but the effect was good.
No, and his father says he's an actor of sorts, you know, and he nailed the accent.
Yes, he did.
Well, that's certainly something to consider. Where, you know, they sort of skipped over creation, and we have this myth taught in our schools that we came from monkeys. Now, one would think that, having heard the congressional hearing on the tipping and capsizing of Guam, certainly one would think that maybe that's true. But here this 8-year-old boy capsized that theory, I would venture to guess.
I was going to say maybe that's what happened to Atlantis.
Yes. What do you suppose would cause somebody to propagate such a lie, let's say?
Well, I don't know that it was a lie. I mean, the guy didn't sound overly brilliant. I think maybe he really believed that nonsense.
Oh, no, no, I'm not speaking about the island capsizing now. I think that's a dead issue, but that's just, you're just witnessing, blatant stupidity there. I mean, come on. Certainly you'd need an extra 5,000 people or so for that to happen.
At least, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm talking about this idea that all of a sudden, somehow man just evolved out of the monkeys, but the monkeys stayed monkeys. Is that just a pun on humanity?
Well, listen, I'm not an expert in the field of genetics, but I'll tell you one thing. A lot of experiments have been done to promote an increase of organization in a given genome. And no matter how many mutations are introduced, it doesn't seem to make a result or produce a result which is upscale from what you started with. And quite frankly, the opposite is a lot more plausible. And I mean, there's a lot of people that will probably frown on this idea, but I think that man has de-evolved rather than come up from monkeys. I think we're headed in that direction instead, because people are definitely getting stupider by the minute.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the reality of it goes, I mean, there are features that men have. I don't mean just men; mankind has. That are not explained very easily, even by Darwin's theory, which everybody seems to be so fond of. But they do make sense if you consider the possibility that that mankind is essentially the mean, the geometric mean, for that matter, of a being of higher status that was blended with a being of lower status. That could possibly work. And there's a lot of speculation on the possibilities in that direction. But I have not yet read or encountered anywhere any theory whatsoever that shows how one species could evolve into another one. Because natural selection is a form of, isolation and focus that is expedited by nature itself under certain conditions, and it will introduce very dramatic changes. But to my knowledge, no one species has ever changed into another one as a result of that. I mean, they even tried to accelerate that process, you know, in the laboratory. They've taken ordinary rabbits, for instance, who multiply very quickly, and they've measured the ears on a particular generation of rabbits, and only selected those with the longest ears to mate with those that also had the longest ears. And in just a few generations, they had rabbits with ears that were in excess of 12 inches long. But they were still rabbits. So, you know, if you play that game with, let's say, with other bodily parts, like the forelegs or the hind legs, can you produce a kangaroo? I don't know. But I doubt it.
Well, I know that you could take a human being and put them in politics and turn them into a jackass.
Put them in what, Tom?
Put them in politics. Give them a career in politics, and they'll turn into a jackass.
Oh yeah, that's a very well known scenario. But you see, in that respect, they're de-evolving, aren't they?
I don't know. I'd hate to insult the jackass, you know, the real jackass. You get my point.
Indeed.
Yes. Now, on some past shows, Jim, you and I discussed this Hadron Super Collider, and we speculated, and I know we speculated quite accurately that if they were to succeed in causing two opposite or opposing streams of atoms to collide into each other at incredible speeds, that they would probably do great damage to all of Europe, if not totally wipe it out, and maybe certain parts of the rest of the world. Certainly the world would not function. The Earth itself as a planet would not be functioning properly. And it would be a catastrophe of immeasurable or inconceivable proportions, very possibly. All of this in an attempt to recreate the moment that they like to call the Big Bang, the moment that life was born throughout the universe. And I understand that process as being called the creation, in terms of what God would call it, what the creator would call it, the source, the prime source, whatever name you want to give, the all of everything that is, and that they can somehow duplicate this with the machine and expect to see the same results is insanity. And then you have these same people teaching kids in school and teenagers and adults that somehow we were an accident that just happened to come into existence as a result of some unnatural replication of DNA or genes or cells or molecules, whatever you want to call the process of evolution. And it doesn't deal with the aspect of spirituality at all. I've heard many a scientist say that animals don't have spirits, and yet those of us that know and love and appreciate nature and the animal kingdom know quite well that animals do have spirits. They demonstrate that in a multitude of ways, which sort of slaps this theory in the face. I say this theory, this garbage that they feed us, expecting us, to swallow it hook, line, and sinker. And many do, unfortunately. Many people are brainwashed from the outset into thinking that these things that they teach us in school are based in truth. And I don't know how you felt when you were in school. Maybe you would share that. Did it make sense what they were teaching you?
Well, first of all, things were very different back then. And to be quite honest with you, I went to a Catholic school, in which case they only taught the creation idea. But I did a lot of reading on my own, even as a child. And I didn't see any trouble with the idea of a creator being active in the production of all the various life forms on Earth. It was only a question of how he did it. And, the most dogmatic religious interpretation of creation is, like the stage trick of a magician, where the guy just steps up and says, poof, and there's a rabbit. Poof, there's a camel. That might be how some people envision it. I think that the creation of all these different creatures may have been a lot more involved than that, and we'll probably never understand the total process. But the idea that we have to accept this concept of evolution, and incidentally, while we're on that subject, just so you know, anybody that wants to pick up a book about Darwin and his original investigations on the Galapagos Islands, which led him to understand natural selection, will be very surprised to find that he doesn't talk about any of the things that are attributed to evolution nowadays. He talks about deviations of characteristics within a given species. And he never tried to extrapolate that line of thought into a mechanism that would explain the appearance of, mastodons from frogs, for instance. I mean, that's just ridiculous. He never tried to do that. So whoever jumped on board with his basic idea and then kidnapped it to pervert it into the modern way of thinking was an extremist. And we seem to have an awful lot of them lately. Now, the other thing that makes an awful lot of sense, or at least it used to, was that if you advance a theory in any given field, it's a theory. And a theory means that it's something that needs to be proven or disproven before it can be categorized. So, you have a theory that mass can be converted into matter in a nuclear explosion. Well, now we know that that's a theory that's true. Okay? How do we get to that conclusion? Spent millions of dollars, had tens of thousands of scientists working on the problem, built a whole city dedicated to understanding the physics of fission, and eventually, through experimentation and study, they produced the effect. So now they know it's real. Well, I think that the same type of reasoning needs to be applied to any other theory, including the theory of evolution. If these people really want us to swallow the idea, that a field mouse can turn into an elephant, then I think they want to produce experimental results that verify the validity of that concept. And until they do that, people have to realize that it's only a theory. There are lots of theories, thousands of them. Some are real and some are not. And the entire scientific process was originally designed to separate the wheat from the chaff and leave us with a solid core of facts upon which further study and further hypothecation could be developed. But unfortunately, over the years, and I've seen this happen just since I was a kid, experimentation of things like that and the funding necessary to study things like that have been slowly ebbing away and being done away with, and yet the basic hypothesis remains and becomes dogma rather than scientific fact. And that is always what happens before there is a major collapse of information, of science in general, possibly even of society. You know, when things get to the point where you're dealing with only folklore, mysticism, and dogma, watch out, because then anything goes. And we've actually reached that point in a lot of directions.
Yes. You know, what comes to mind listening to you describe these different thoughts about the same topic. You've heard of the 100th monkey theory.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
And I suppose at some point the 100th monkey, after having discovered how to crack open a coconut and extract the meat from inside, and maybe possibly even after having drunk the milk inside the coconut, decided, wow, this would be great to use as a weapon. So I'm going to transmute myself or shapeshift into another being so I can create cannonballs and open up some banks where I can profit from this. You know, in other words, we've gone from coconuts to war and central banks and the repression of society. So your point about devolution is well taken, because if we did come from monkeys, we have devolved. I don't see monkeys going around the planet creating wars and starving people, spraying the skies with chemtrails, trying to vaccinate beings, putting fluorides in the water and toxins in the food. Monkeys aren't doing that, so your point is well taken. If we evolved from monkeys, we have devolved into what we are today. And there is an intention, anyway, to devolve the species. That is quite evident. And I'm sort of ranting on the issue, but just to contemplate the validity or the possibility that theory could actually hold any truth reveals how idiotic it is. And yet you have people that earn their living putting this crap out there, teaching this, putting this into the minds of impressionable young children as if they're going to have some deeper understanding about the universe. It's really sad. It's a sad case for where mankind is at the higher level. You know, and this little song, that's the boy that sang this song, "Did Charlie Make a Monkey Out of You?" there's a lot of truth in that song, and certainly in the lyrics. The supposition that we evolved from a reptilian form somewhere along, then transformed into primates, simians, if you want to call them that. And then, and they say, well, they're our cousins. You know, well, then the reptiles are our cousins too, then. There is no difference. I mean, this is what I see politicians claiming. They're all related to each other. Doesn't matter what their race is or their political party. They just come up with all kinds of ridiculous comments as to how they're related. And it's not true whatsoever. That's been debunked. It's just the it's more lies that they put out there. So again, you're right in saying that this species called humanity has devolved, at least in brain power, or in the capacity to use the brain as a functioning organ. We don't use it for the purpose it was created, and I would venture to guess that most don't know how to use it. They never really learned how to use it. And it's been basically molded into a knee-jerk responsive entity that has no basis in reality whatsoever. Any thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, before I comment on that, what I would like to do is just back up a little bit to something you said earlier, because I think it really encapsulates the grain of truth behind this whole thing that's actually accessible to us. And we had started off, you asked me if I had heard of this 100th monkey situation, which of course I have. We talked about it on other shows, actually.
Yes.
But the basic idea of that is that apparently when one animal, and I doubt very much if it's limited only to the species of monkeys. I mean, it's probably something that's universal. It just hasn't been studied like so many other things.
Sure.
But when one monkey discovers something, like, for instance, how to use a twig to get termites out of a tree, you know, it's a tool. So when he starts using that, and then he teaches another monkey, or the other monkey sees him doing that, and then imitates, it seems that when there's enough of this going on, a certain critical mass is reached, then that information spreads throughout the species, even if the colony that organized it or originated it is completely separate from other monkeys. Now, that's been proven to be true. You know, the original studies were done, I think, in northern Japan. I forget the name of those kind of monkeys they have up there. They're snow monkeys, but, I mean, I don't remember the species. But essentially, they were on islands completely separated from one another. And when they learned a particular gimmick, the rest of the tribes on other islands and on the mainland just knew about it, you know, as if by magic. Well, that's the part that is so important and so interesting. You know, I think that what it's insinuating is that all species, and I would include man in this comment as well, has the ability to tap into some type of a communal mind, and when something that's beneficial to the species as a whole reaches a certain level of intensity or a certain degree of exposure, it's downloaded and becomes common knowledge automatically. Now, the reason this is an exciting thing is because it bears proof, in my opinion, of a spiritual component to life.
Yes.
There isn't any other explanation for it, you know. I mean, even if you want to be absolutely materialistic and say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's a form of telepathy, or it has some explanation in the realm of you know, high frequency radiation emitted by the monkey's brains. It doesn't make any difference how you define it. It's not physical. Okay, so there's a spiritual element involved in this. And
now,
I'm sorry, go ahead, Don.
Oh, I was just going to make a quick comment. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I heard a pause there, so I was going to interject that these monkeys, whether it's on a conscious or an unconscious level, are tapping into what we know as universal mind in metaphysics. It's the creation. It's the grid that's there. And they can access that through nature. Now, that man doesn't do that shows that And especially when you examine our religious institutions and our educational institutions and our media institutions, you can see that there's a concerted effort to dumb us down, to disconnect us or separate us from that knowledge. So I just wanted to make that point.
Well, that's fine, because that's what I was leading to, is exactly that, or the converse of that.
Yeah, and the monk you were thinking of is the Macaca Fuscata, or the snow monkey.
Yes. But at any rate, the point here that's important is that this mechanism exists in nature. And, you know, we talk about the fact that man had some kind of a downfall, some kind of a falling, the fall of man. And, you know, it's very nice that this is related to the fable of Adam and Eve, but I think it's something a lot more fundamental and a lot more important than biting into an apple. I think that what really happened when mankind reached a certain level of development and chose to congregate in cities as opposed to living in a more natural environment, it was beneficial for his immediate survival, but it was detrimental to this mechanism. Because when animals live as a component of the gestalt, of the whole, that's when they seem to have this ability to do this. And nothing could be further from natural than the confines of a city. And so I think that something happened when mankind started to change from being a hunter-gatherer type society into being more, to use the term, civilized. We disconnected from the grid, and possibly it was through our own efforts that this happened. Now, I must say that there have been exceptions to this, though. And the ancient Egyptians, and I'm talking about the Old Kingdom Egyptians, you know, 1st through 5th dynasty, I guess, constitutes the Old Kingdom, they seem to remain pretty well in touch with the higher components of themselves. Even though they were living in cities and whatnot. So it would appear that it's possible to do both, but that you have to have, or at least retain, the original level of consciousness that, that was given to the species. And as you say, obviously efforts have been made to deliberately dumb that down in most people today. Now, I can tell you from personal experience as well as from speaking with colleagues who have had absolutely incredible experiences during the courses of their careers, that it's absolutely possible to download information from the God consciousness, the mass mind, you know, the planetary mind, whatever you want to call it. It can be done, and it can be done regularly. The problem is it takes a great deal of concerted effort, and it's like anything else. You have to develop the methodology that allows you to do that, which takes a lot of practice mm-hmm. and a lot of dedication to that task. And if you stop and think about it, the way society is designed, you never get the opportunity to do that. So you have to live in a dog-eat-dog environment all day long, and then when you get home, you want to just crash and relax. And that has been provided for us also by the luxury of television, radio, stereo, God only knows what else, computers. And so there again, the mind is more in a passive mode than it is in an active mode. And, of course, those same channels are also used for propaganda and programming of people. So we never get a chance and I believe it's deliberate, we never get a chance to develop those spiritual connections that we're born with. And as a result of that, we are a very materialistic, very shallow, and very depressed species as compared to what we were, let's say, 5,000-6,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, putting myself in the place of the listeners, the ladies and gentlemen that are listening to this conversation right now, and imagining that there were some wondering, what are these two talking about? Where is this going? Why is this topic important? And what came to mind while you were explaining these possibilities and also your convictions about, you know, who we may be, let's put it that way, and how we came to be. On some past shows, at least two or three shows that you and I have done in the past almost 3 years, Jim, you shared a story about a study in plants where a plant recognized a human that was, let's say, had the aura and the energy that this plant recognized as a danger to itself. It expressed an extreme fear or extreme concern that this person was in its presence, that it could sense and recognize who this person is. Would you share that story with the listeners that likely didn't hear that story?
Sure. That was the work that was done by Clave Baxter in New York back in the 60s. I was associated with a guy who knew him, and that's how I became familiar with the experiments. And I never did meet Mr. Baxter, but I read about the things that he did. And essentially, he was a technician that was dealing with these polygraphs. I forget if it was for the police or if he was servicing them or what he was doing with them. But anyway, he was very familiar with the electronics and the electromechanical aspects of polygraphs. And whatever provoked him to do this, I'm not sure, but he had connected one up to a plant in his office. And he was very surprised to find that the rhythms that were appearing on the paper as the chart scrolled out had all the characteristics of emotions. It's the same type of things that he would see in people. And so he started experimenting with plants and recording their responses on the polygraph. And in the course of doing this, he found that there were several things that really made an impression on the plant. And one of the first things that he did, which showed some type of really violent response, was that he took a beaker of brine shrimp and poured that beaker into a pot of boiling water a few feet away from the plant. And the minute that those shrimp hit that water and died, the plant went ballistic. And maybe it's not right to call it fear or horror or concern. Who knows what it is? Because you know you have enough trouble interpreting the feelings of a person who can at least expound about what he's experiencing. But a plant can't do that. But the point is that it indicated some type of very vigorous response to an event that we as people would probably interpret as either horrible or terrible or unjust, you know, one of those type of feelings. So this amazed him, and he began to widen his scope of researches, and he decided to see just how much consciousness a plant really had. And in order to do this, what was arranged was that he took two plants of the same species that had been in each other's presence for a number of months. And he wired the one plant up to his polygraph equipment, and then he situated the plants a few feet apart and had a parade of people come by and admire the plants. And each person that came up to the plant, their wave response changed a little bit, and it seemed like it was tuning into that person's presence. And unbeknownst to the plant, of course, there was an individual in the line that had a pair of hedge cutters with him. And when he got up to the second plant, which was next to the subject plant, he just took out the hedge cutters and chopped that other plant all to pieces. And in the process of the chopping, the plant that was being monitored went totally ballistic. And these huge, violent swings of the pens on the polygraph indicated some type of hysteria, let's call it that, from the plant that was observing or sensing what was happening. Well, that was only the first part of the experiment. Then they waited several months, and they filed another gang of people past this plant, and in that secondary parade, the same guy that had the hedge cutters in the first experiment was there someplace amongst the crowd. And when he got close to that plant, the plant went ballistic because it recognized him and it feared him. So once he understood this, you know, then there was no doubt in his mind that some type of a transfer of consciousness existed between the human and the plant, or else this couldn't happen. But to solidify it even more as a scientific truth, what he did was he started training with a particular plant. And he had the plant wired up not only to the polygraph, but to a series of circuit discriminators, which literally could be adjusted to respond to a particular range of frequencies. And every time that he he wasn't doing this by thinking about something. He was doing this by conjuring up feelings. So apparently there's a very big difference between the two, even if we don't make that distinction ourselves. So like, mm-hmm. for instance, if he thought about kissing his wife, the plant would give one response, and then he would tune one of these circuits to that response until the signal was amplified to the point where whenever he thought about kissing his wife, that particular circuit would be activated and it would close a relay. And then he would think about something else, like playing with his children or playing catch with the dog, you know, whatever. And he had it down to the point where there were five or six of these discrete circuits that became active upon his personal choice just by what he conjured up within him emotionally. So, for instance, if he thought about kissing his wife, he could open and close the garage door. If he thought about playing with his kids, the stereo could come on. If he thought about running around with the dog, you know, the TV would change channels, you know, that type of thing. And then he took this to the point where he could do this from miles and miles away. even when he was on a business trip all the way across the country, if he phoned his wife and asked her to turn on the equipment and to report back to him on the telephone what happens, if he thought about kissing her, the garage door opened. You know, the same things happened. So distance didn't play any part in it. And the last I heard was that the military had gotten a hold of this, and they found a way to take a plant which had been trained in this manner and encapsulate some very minuscule portion of that plant. And I think that they found that even if the plant was dead after it had been trained like this, there were still electrical responses or electrical changes in the organic material that composed the plant. And they put this into a chip, which they called the mind chip, or the mind switch. That's what it was, mind switch. And had it connected up with various amplifiers and detector circuits. And they duplicated what Clave Baxter's original work was with this mental switch or mind switch. And one of the things that they did with it, which was the last I heard many years ago, when the Apollo mission went around the dark side of the moon, one of the astronauts who had previously been trained to work with this mind switch activated a mind switch on Earth while he was on the other side of the moon. And the response was instantaneous and as if distance meant nothing. So this gives you some insight. And don't forget, if they were doing this in the 60s and early 70s, only God knows what they're doing now. But the point is that there are other forces and there are other avenues of expression that nature has, which we are not aware of in our modern civilized world. That does not mean that the ancients didn't know about it. And it doesn't mean that it isn't commonplace in the animal kingdom.
Yes, I agree. In fact, I would echo your sentiments and your comments by saying that because we have been taught something totally erroneous in that regard, or we've been steered away from our true self, doesn't make it, it doesn't invalidate what you just described. In fact, your description of the plants, which make no decision about whether or not they're going to abide by the laws of the universe or the laws of nature, they just do it. It's the way to exist. And yet, I suppose on some level that plants would have the choice, but if they do, they've made the logical choice on how to thrive, how to propagate, how to exist. And in the case of perennials, maybe perennials are the plants that man hasn't been able to change. Maybe, you know, the annuals, the ones that have to be replanted from the seeds, have been tampered with by mankind. And so they die at the end of the growing season or when winter approaches. Trees, I notice. The oak trees in my yard, for instance, 2 years ago, went through a massive transformation in that they suspected that there was a drought, and it's built into them to produce more acorns. I had barrels and barrels of acorns that I was shoveling because it would have choked the lawn and the other greenery in the yard. And the trees in my neck of the woods, no pun intended, basically all reacted the same way. All of these plants and trees knew something that we didn't know. And so they went into a mode which allowed them to ensure their reproduction, the continuing of the species. But they didn't try to become reptiles, nor did they try to become simians, and they certainly made a wise choice in not becoming people or attempting to mimic people. They were acorns, and the following spring, those that I didn't get up, those that had found their way into the soil, either through the snowpack or by accident, knew that they were trees, and I had little oak trees sprouting up all over the place, as did any of my neighbors that had oak trees in their yard. They had the same issue. So there's an intelligence at work there. And it's, I don't think the plant kingdom has to labor to tap into that source that you're describing. You and I have talked about this many times. It's a form of consciousness, and all they have to do is follow the laws of nature. Congress could write laws until the cows came home, and it wouldn't affect those trees and how they react or anything in the plant kingdom. But Congress passes laws to create substances, chemicals to spray on plants to destroy them. See, it's all they can do. They can't think of creating life. It's all destructive. And I think we have some things to learn about ourselves when we contemplate these types of possibilities. Don't you, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, in your little soliloquy there, you touched on something else that I had forgotten about, but I really want to interject it if I have a moment to do that.
Yes, yes, we do have one moment, sure.
When I was in Peru about 14 years ago, I had the good fortune of meeting quite a few interesting people. And one of these people was, I don't think he was a shaman in his own right, but he certainly had been with shamans. And these people that are practicing these shamanistic rites have knowledge that we don't have, and they have sensitivities that we don't have. And one of the things that fascinated me was their ability to go off into the woods and come back with exactly the right herb, leaf, twig, root, whatever, to produce a healing effect in people. And so that was my area of interest and my focus in the conversation I had with this gentleman. And I asked him, you know, how is this information passed on from one generation to the other? I mean, is it all written down, you know, like grandma's recipes, or is there some other thing that goes on? And he said, well, of course, some of them get written down, especially the ones that are used most frequently. He said, but actually, what they learn is how to communicate directly with the plants. And if they go into the woods to find a cure for something, they will literally interrogate the plants. And the plants will tell that shaman what they were created for, what they are good for, how they will affect the human being. And that's how they learn which plants cure what. The plants actually tell them that. Now, I didn't take that as a fable. I didn't take it as, you know, modern day BS. I believe it 100%. And I think that this is a trait that animals have too, by the way, because you can take a rabbit, for instance, and have him out in a field somewhere, and he will avoid plants that are poisonous to him and just eat grasses and things that he knows are okay. But if you remove that animal from the field and put him in a cage, you can feed him plants that he would actually avoid in nature, he will eat them and die. And that experiment has also been done. So when you separate a human being or an animal from the environment that they were created to be a part of, something gets lost in the process. There's no two ways about it.
Well said. And I would speculate that since this show was most likely heard by someone in Guam through our Wind Talkers radio network, or just on BBS on the internet, the plants in the jungles are probably laughing at the congressman from Georgia. just at the thought that the island would tip over and capsize.
Do have a couple of floating islands, but I understand that they were man-made.
Okay. Well, Jim, we're out of time. I think we've left our listening audience with something to contemplate over the weekend. I'm going to have a shaman on my show next Tuesday. Dr. B. Sirius will be with us, and we're going to be talking about some very interesting topics. We're going to certainly talk about parasitic infestation of the human species, as well as the excitotoxins that are used to dumb us down. So this will be a continuing series next week. If you're able to tune in on Tuesday night, you might want to do that. But I want to thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you told me that.
Yeah. I want to thank you for your contribution to tonight's show. And I want you to know that regardless of the true date of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, and I know that you're not an especially religious man, but you do honor God, and you do bring quite a bit of sense, even from the scientific realm, into the concept of spirituality and great spiritual beings. This being the Easter weekend, I want to wish you a happy Easter.
Well, thank you, Don. The same to you and yours.
Okay, and we'll see you next Friday. That will be the 9th of April. And in the meantime, have a great weekend, Jim. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, Wind Talkers Radio Network, and BlogTalkRadio.com. Special thanks to Seth Hendrick and Don Newsom for doing the sound tonight. Also want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish all the listening audience out there, especially those in the U.S. military, a very happy and peaceful Easter, and have a great weekend. In the meantime, I wish everyone else a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.